Hello. I'm a partner in a law firm. the question I have... Is it working? The question I have, I think, is for all the panel, which is lawyers and probably other professional advisors, one common criticism is that they tend to focus too much on giving professional advisory services, and they tend to neglect the importance of marketing and PR. And as a result, they're very good at giving advice on law or accounting or whatever the area is, but they're not very good at going out and winning new business. And I think the question is to all the panelists, if you were sitting down with a lawyer or an accountant or some other kind of professional advisor, and you were giving them some kind of marketing makeover and trying to identify where the common problems were that you'd come across, what advice would you be giving to them?
Do you want me to kick off? In a word, I'd say perspective. I think that as guilty as, and particularly you're talking the legal industry here, is of that, my industry, the PR industry is as well, which is far too focused on its own discipline. And I think that the more that we as professional service providers can actually display and articulate a broader perspective and a broader understanding of the issues that might be in front of them and recognise they bring one area of expertise to that issue, there's a lot of other perspectives that need to be brought into it, then I think you're of more value to your prospective client.
Can I make an observation? And this is just because it's quite close to personal experience previously, and that is, I think that you, in the legal profession, have one of the greatest challenges of all the different industries, and that's partly because if you go down the advertising route, people are going to accuse you of being an ambulance chaser, and if you go down the PR route, there's a real risk that no one's going to have a clue what you're talking about, because as I was accused when I came out of a law degree and moved into PR, I was accused of being slightly verbose, and I remember writing a press release using the word unconscionable and having my boss turn around to me and say, James, why not just say it's not fair? So now as a publisher, we're selling advertising to law firms, and the challenge that you face is that you're not selling the shiny chrome finish or the smooth leather of the handbag. You're selling an expertise, and once you're selling an expertise, there's a significant challenge. And I think that significant challenge goes beyond pure advertising or PR on its own and must be extended to include things like direct mail, newsletters, marketing, conferences, events, asking questions. By the way, what firm are you from? Okay. Ask him later. But I couldn't keep my mouth shut because it's dear to the heart. Has anyone got any other comments for the gentleman here?
I'll have a crack at this question, though. I think if we were sitting down opposite you, the first question that I would ask you and counsel you on is to clarify what sort of law firm you are. That the mistake that companies make is they don't think of themselves like any other product, and that's what they are. And any product needs to differentiate itself from other products in the category. We're in a Me Too world, and whether it's fridges or toothpaste or cars, there's exactly the same thing just down the road with another badge on it. Exactly the same thing. It's just a question of which one suits you best. And with law firms, they're not all things to all people. Law isn't a ubiquitous thing in the sense of, you know, there's real estate law and commercial law and, you know, all sorts of other law, criminal law and so on. And it's a question of being clear first on what you guys want to stand for, what sort of law firm you want to be, not only in terms of the disciplines, but the values you have that differentiate you from the other law firms. Once you've clarified that, then you know what audience you're going after, you know what you want to say about yourselves, and then you can go and market in a way that's relevant to you. So the point that I would start at is working out why you exist. And that's not to sell legal services, because everybody else does that. Everyone else in your category does that. Why do you exist? And once you've answered that question, all the rest will follow.
I'd also just add to that, is that in working with the arts, we have to work with a number of legal firms, pro bono work, and I have just had the most patronising, awful relationships with so many legal firms in Victoria because they're just not willing to get to know the industry that you're in. They walk in often with an arrogance, an intellectual arrogance, and it's completely patronising. And so I think a willingness to... you should, as a basic rule, obviously respect your client, but a willingness to engage with their world, I think, is incredibly important, because understanding the nuance of what they're bringing to you, I think, is really important.
I just kind of thought, has anyone seen Max Super? It's a superannuation firm. Like, when I use the word superannuation, don't you just want to cut your throat? But Max Super became the friendly super people. I don't know why a law firm doesn't do that. Personally, I don't know any friendly law firms. Any more questions? Yeah.
Can I just make a few responses to those, the answers we just received?
Interactive.
I thought they were very good answers, actually. I thought the one about having a product was spot on. The problem with a lot of law firms and proper other accountancy practices is they don't think about how they differentiate themselves from their competitors. So I think the answer about you've got to understand where you sit in the market, what your product is absolutely right. I like the comments about intellectual aloofness. That is something you do get feedback from on a lot of clients, that they don't like that about their lawyers or the professional advisors. And I think the point about perspective was good as well. What one thing you tend to find with lawyers is they tend to think that their advice operates in a vacuum. They don't understand that it's really just something that has to operate in a commercial environment and has to be provided in a way which facilitates commercial ends being reached. They don't understand that. And the point about ambulance and chasers, I don't know. But perhaps that explains why you packed in law.
By the way, I do know lots of friendly lawyers and friendly law firms, but they're never presented as friendly. The question's down the front here.
Hi, this is for everyone on the panel. I recently read a really interesting quote by David Packard from Hewlett Packard, who said that marketing is far too important to leave to the marketing department. And my question is, when you're developing a campaign for an organisation, do you think that it's incredibly important to educate that organisation about the campaign messages so that everyone from the receptionist to the director can also deliver those messages?
Do you want me to go first? It is, and I tell you why, because whether it's advertising or public relations or another communication tool, it really should be the personification of the company. And if it's truly the personification of the company, then every part of that company should act and perform and share and in the same way and share those values. And whether it's finance or production or whatever, they need to understand that that's probably the most accessible understanding of what the company stands for. And so they've got to understand what's behind it and act in a similar way.
In the arts, sometimes the dichotomy that exists between those who are producing art and marketing can be so completely destructive, because there is a sense that one person is making something from the heart and one person is just turning it into units and products and content and really don't care about what actually is being made or sold. So a holistic attitude towards the production of, you know, of a festival, of a theatre work, is absolutely imperative.
Not much more to add to that.
Hi, I'm down the front here. I am after a comment, actually, about the Snowy Hydro situation, so if I could try and get a comment from all of you. At the one time we had international financiers and merchant bankers using advertising to sell the sale of Pacific of Snowy Hydro, and we all saw the ads in bus stops and train stations and on television and newspapers to sign up to a website before the thing even went to sale. Now, it seems to me that through public relations, and this didn't involve a company, as has been mentioned many times today, but it actually involved people, public relations actually killed the whole sale of an asset, which is about, I don't know, $1 billion or more. So what I'm looking for maybe is a comment on the fact that the Prime Minister pulled out of the sale on the back of allegedly having listened to the people, as well as Senator Bill Heffernan and some others, and at the same time we had this whole advertising thing going on. So it seems to me like people and PR maybe actually killed the sale of a $1 billion asset.
I'll make the comment because it's a classic scenario and it happens again and again and again and again. And the model is this. They say, we need to change public opinion and we need to get something happening. Let's sign an advertising, you know, develop an advertising brief and we'll communicate that way. We'll engage a PR firm and the PR firm will go out and they'll communicate with all the stakeholders, the VIPs, so we've got all our ducks in a row and everything can get done. And the case I'm thinking of is with genetic crops. But what they always leave out is this grassroots movement. And you're right, it's the people at the bottom. And classic PR, and even if you read the textbooks, they actually neglect that group. Mm-hmm. So what you have the advertising people, PR people talking to the stakeholders, the councillors, the political leaders, the business leaders, and everyone's forgetting that bottom mix. The difference is now is that I think that those people can be reached, but those people can be reached through different mediums, and they tend to be things like blogs, activist groups, and that sort of thing. But it's an interesting equation because it happens again and again and again and again, and only in the last 4 years I can think of about four scenarios. But
yeah, I agree, and I think the reason that it's been neglected so universally over the history of PR has been that things have changed in the last sort of 5 to 10 years. It has been technology that now makes grassroots coordination of grassroots campaigns a lot easier and a lot more effective. And so you are now seeing companies which are specifically targeting this area. And I think that, ironically, it's sort of the mining companies that I think probably lead the way as far as really community-level engagement is the buzzword of the minute. And so you have seen some, you know, probably your more forward-thinking companies in that regard, or the companies with more to lose if they get it wrong, have actually really, really headed down this path and are investing heavily in community-based grassroots engagement. I don't think that a lot of people do it well, and I don't think as sort of a proportion of your marketing pie, you know, it's still very much the poor cousin. I suspect that'll change significantly because people power, I think, is getting a whole lot louder voice now, courtesy of what technology is allowing them to do in coordinating efforts and to get messages across to specific audiences in real time.
You're absolutely right. The ability for people to communicate now with each other and create a grassroots movement is much more powerful than it was 10 or 20 years ago because of the web. But the most important thing to remember, I think, and I don't take sides in that issue, I'm not sure I know what side to take, I haven't even thought about it, but the bottom line of it is this, that there's a perception that companies and governments have huge budgets to spend money to manipulate and influence opinion and so on and so forth. The reality is that if people are misled, it's a function of their own laziness not to inform themselves of what the issues are. And I touched on it before, at the risk of being cast as an advocate for advertising or communication generally. If messages don't resonate with people, people won't do what that message wants them to do. The mere fact that people advertise or take a position doesn't automatically mean that everybody else follows. And we've seen it. There's thousands of stories. Anton's been involved in them. I've been involved in them. Where we've taken on certain commercial projects that have failed. Not because we haven't done a good job or because we haven't been creative in the messages that we've developed, but because those messages haven't resonated with consumers. So I don't know enough about this instance to have a view one way or the other as to what's right. But at the end of the day, the power is with people to make decisions, not with advertising or PR or us people who pull strings supposedly behind the black curtain. It just, I'm sure there are examples of that happening, but in a democracy it's very hard to get people to do things they don't inherently want to do.
There's a Harvard Business Review case study about the Bush election where they got people out to vote using classic PR, engaging celebrities plus advertising. It was called Rock the Vote. However, the Bush camp employed highly sophisticated technology to door knock anyone that they knew as a Republican, and you know the outcome of that campaign.
But also with the Snowy campaign, and sort of goes back to something I was saying before, the reversal on that decision was so quick that it makes me feel like it was a campaign to flag it as a problem for government to refer to their internal polling, which already would have been in place in terms of people's concerns about privatisation within the country. Because in my experience, certainly with government, decisions take such a long time. And so I was really fascinated by that campaign because it was both, you know, flag, you know, it was demonstration to government, flag, do your own polling and check it out, but also we have actually media behind us and we're going to make you look bad, and they had to wrap it up really quickly. So I think a lot of things were going on in there, and I don't think it was solely people power overturned the government. I think it had to have been occurring in government at the same time for them to have already had those figures to say, yes, this is going to hurt us in an election year and it's going to hurt Peter Costello after the budget. So I think a few things were going on, in my humble opinion, as a comedy festival marketing director.
What? This is a bloody fantastic answer.
Yeah.
It's Vanessa at the club. More questions.
First of all, I'm really pleased as a law firm marketer that we actually have some lawyers in the room. I think that's fantastic. And I think we should listen to what Vanessa had to say as a user of the service. And
I did law for 3 days.
So you knew what you were talking about.
Yeah.
You said you weren't funny.
My question, I guess, picks up on that last element of conversation, something that Vanessa mentioned about online and the democratisation of the market, if I could put it that way. As marketers, we're all trying to be control freaks, and yet we have this online process that's democratising and disempowering marketers, if I could put it that way. Vanessa, would you put on your own website for the festival a review that was negative for one of your acts?
Absolutely. Because certainly within the arts, okay, I'll start back. Our audience is incredibly sophisticated and has been to the festival for a number of years. There is a number of rules, in term, not rules, but there are certain sort of things that people talk about, that if there's a company has received a 5-star review and has also received a 1-star review, then you should see it because it's completely polarising audiences, and that's interesting artistically. So, yes, we would absolutely put up a weak article.
Funny that you used the word disempowered, but at the same time, it's dramatically empowered. And I'm thinking about the editor of Dolly magazine. Now, she runs a chat room and a blog, which apparently is visited by something like 200,000 schoolgirls a week. Unique visitors, anytime she wants to make a decision about what's going to go on the front cover or what the lead story is, whether it's going to be Ashton Kutcher or the guy from OC, I don't know, but I've got to catch up on my teenage girl magazine literature. But she knows that that as a result of that, she knows exactly what to place in every single edition of the magazine. And there's talk now, I think Ron mentioned at the beginning about the digitisation of entertainment, and it will come to a point where television programmers won't exist, publishers or editors like myself won't be necessary, and the reason why is because the process will allow people to self-select what news they want to choose based on their previous choices. So just
Dolly is an interesting example because that's quite pernicious, because the Dolly editor also works with the advertising department, and it's kind of this non-advertising advertising space. So if there is a huge buy into Dolly or into any other publication in their suite, she'll also say, did you happen to notice that turquoise boots are in this summer? And just check out page 34. And that kind of thing happens. So it's kind of this other guise, and that's what's also difficult now, I think, with blogs and that kind of, I call it sort of insincere connection to your audience, where you're trying to sort of mask it and make it seem like it's very personal. It's all just her sitting at the desk going la 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 la. But it's not. She's got five editors all writing that for her. I don't like her. I'm prepared to admit it.
Uh-oh, we need like a lawyer.
On that point, Ron, empower or disempower?
I'm glad you asked me, because I was busting to answer that question.
Sorry.
Look, I think the, as some of you have said, the democratisation of the media, if you like, has disempowered us. The truth of it is, it comes down to us having to be smarter and tailoring our message in a one-to-one way with our consumers. And there was a question I saw in the notes we got about the trends for the future. We certainly won't be mass marketing like we used to. We'll be understanding people on an individual basis better and learning to communicate with them cost effectively and individually. It comes back to my comment about this from this fellow over here, the lawyer over here, that if you know what your business stands for, then you know who you can resonate with, and you can communicate that with those people in a much more relevant way rather than a mass way. So the answer to your question is it's definitely empowering, but it is profoundly changing our profession. There is no question about that.
Do you think that individual marketing, in terms of suggesting that you know your customer via their preferences and via their technology, and yet you've never seen them, spoken to them, is sincere? Like, because I'm finding it becoming quite overwhelming now, that I'm kind of fitting into this deterministic pattern buying behaviour that, oh, if you like this, Vanessa, you like this and this and this. And I'm getting actually quite angry.
Yeah, you should throw away this word democratisation and replace it with perhaps the Googlification.
I think to answer Vanessa's question, I think if anything, whether it's traditional ways we went about communicating or non-traditional ways, in other words, the new ways, if it's insincere, then we shouldn't be doing it, and ultimately it won't be very effective. Consumers are, we've taught them to be smart. They've learned over the last 30-odd years of consumerism how to discern what they want. There's research now that shows that kids of 4 can discern the credibility in advertising far faster than their parents, because they've grown up with it for the short time they've been on the earth. And anything that's insincere or perceived to be insincere is just not going to work. So what I'm talking about is a true understanding of those consumers, that and if it resonates with them, they'll buy it. And if it doesn't resonate with them, stand back, because they're lethal. You know, they just won't buy the product or the service or change their opinion the way you would like them to change their opinion, if it's, you know, social marketing or government or whatever. So that issue of sincerity, it just doesn't change. The values don't change. Just the means of trying to communicate with people does.
Question up the back.
My name is Tim Todhunter from Tricom. We're a wealth management business, and we have marketing issues there. But the main reason I'm standing up is that I detect in the community at large at the moment a tremendous cynicism of weasel words that particularly come from politicians and senior businessmen. And the community doesn't very sceptical indeed of the very substantial amount of apparent PR that is put into the delivery of messages which we don't trust. And I think you probably agree with me that there is a very substantial feeling and opinion in the community in this respect. The question then is, what are you guys going to do about it?
Start with, to use a weasel word, the spin doctor over here.
What are we going to do about it? I endorse your observation. I think you're spot on. And if I look at the various exponents, particularly, I'll talk about PR specifically. You look at the various exponents of PR and the cynicism with which politicians are held, and the frustration that you sense people get when they're wanting an answer to a question they can't get it. And then you look at someone like, say, Richard Branson, and whether you like him or hate him, Richard Branson, I think, is probably one of the best exponents of PR in the world, and that's because he doesn't come across as though he's been PR'd. He will talk to his interview. You know, he'll sit forward like this. He will chat. He will say things that are just him. Whereas I think that my industry has gone through saying, you know, James Tuckerman, if you're about to be interviewed, you know, make sure your coat's been pulled down, and make sure that you're looking in a certain direction, and make sure that you're using this sort of language, and, you know, capture everything within 5 seconds. And I just think we've overdone it. I think we've over PR'd it. And so I think that the next evolution, and it sort of aligns with where things are happening with web-based communications, is actually bringing it more to the everyday. And so the people who are talking look, sound, are more like the audience that they're trying to deal with, as opposed to being key-messaged within an inch of their life. And I don't only blame PR, the industry, for that to some extent. I also blame the news, particularly the electronic news institutions, because the way news is crafted and broadcast is that it needs to be to a certain formula. It needs to be that they won't put a stutter to air, that they won't put a slip-up. And so, therefore, that's how we train people to talk. It's not how people talk in real life.
And it's an ongoing challenge as well, too, because we're training people to talk by email, which adds expressions like with respect to, regarding, as mentioned, as discussed, which is just abbreviated ways of communicating messages in email. But as a publisher, I've found this, what's just been raised there, the infiltration of weasel words into our everyday language, almost impossible to avoid or overcome. In fact, I can safely say that despite how hard we try and write copy to make it original and have headlines that break rules, mess around with text structure, have a sentence like "sounds lame!" exclamation mark, hell yeah, sound lame? Question mark, hell yeah! Exclamation mark, but with a capital B, and breaking all those rules, we have appeared on a website dedicated to identifying weasel words. And I looked at what was identified as a weasel word, and I couldn't see it as such. It was the expression "fast growth business." So it is a challenge, because where does it begin, where does it end? And I think it's just the nature of the evolution of language. And George Orwell was talking about this a long time ago. Or am I getting it wrong? Was it Aldous Huxley? But it was corporate speak, it will never end, and it will continue to happen. And sadly, I don't think we can avoid it.
But the short answer is the market will ultimately dictate that. I mean, if the market absorbs it and accepts it, it won't change. If there's an alternative and people don't go to it, it won't change. I mean, ultimately, we are the ultimate arbiter of that level of cynicism. And if you don't like John Howard, you can vote him out. And there are always alternatives, but if they don't resonate with the community, it's because the community is at least comfortable with what they've got at the moment. And we do control that. There's no question there's a level of cynicism about big business and politics, and there has been for a very long time. But we can change it, because people set themselves up as alternatives. But if they don't resonate, it won't change. So it's not, as much as Anton was very brave to take some of the responsibility, and I'm sure we as communicators need to take some responsibility for the cynicism that we all agree is in the, that level of cynicism in the market. But at the end of the day, we have the power to change it. It's down to us. You can't blame the PR industry or politicians. They, you know, we all have things to say about John Howard, but, you know, he's one of the longest-serving politicians of all time and one of the longest-serving prime ministers of all time. So we can pull him apart piece by piece, but the fact of the matter is he's there because we put him there. So there must be a certain level of acceptance of what he stands for.